Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Joel Cherney. Today I will be speaking with Joe Street, author of the book Dirty Harry's America, Clint Eastwood, Harry Callahan, and the Conservative Backlash. The book was published in 2016 by the University Press of Florida. Eastwood's Dirty Harry character was featured in five films, from the first in 1971 to The Deadpool, the final installment, in 1988. While Don Siegel, director of the first, specifically denied tried to make any political statement with Dirty Harry, the character was quickly seen as a law and order answer to the current events of the time. Joe and I talk about how he decided to tell this story and discuss the making of the series. Welcome, Joe Street. I'm talking to Joe Street, author of Dirty Harry's America, Clint Eastwood, Harry Callahan, and the Conservative Backlash. Now, this was a book I saw a reference to. In fact, actually, the New Books Network had a copy of it sent by the publisher, and immediately was something I was called to because it's an interesting topic from the very beginning. The films, the Dirty Harry films in particular, are, you know, have always been quite controversial and interesting, even when they first came out. So I wanted to get a chance to talk to you about the book. So beforehand, though, let's get a little bit of your background. This is not your first book, but obviously what's your education and other kinds of background that sort of leads you to write a book about Dirty Harry?
Well, sort of my backstory, you might say. My first book, which came out of my PhD thesis, was all about the African-American civil rights movement. And what I wanted to do with that book was examine the ways that civil rights protesters, like the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and various other groups, used cultural forms like theater, art, music, most obviously comedy at times, to put forward their political views. And that book simply finished a little bit of a period in my life, you might say. Once I'd got that book out, I was casting around for something else to write about. And at the same time, I was teaching a module at my first permanent job at the University of Kent at Canterbury, all about America in the 1960s. And Kent had asked me to design this module with a view to incorporating visual elements, and I thought, well, we might as well have some film in there, and I would pair up each week with a film. And when we were doing American conservatism, I thought, well, you know, these are kids who've grown up in the 2000s, probably haven't heard of Dirty Harry, and I thought it was actually an ideal film for them to watch and to think about some of the themes that were important to late 1960s conservatism. And I remember vividly one seminar where the students were bemoaning the reading. And they were saying, well, you know, we've got all of these ideas about this movie. How come nobody else has written about it? And then one of them said, Joe, why don't you write about it? And so I did. And I wrote an article which was published in an academic journal called The 60s, which basically became the chapter on Dirty Harry, the original film in the book. And that went well, and I then just sort of carried on writing, and within a few years I had enough for a book, and here it is.
So where are you currently teaching?
I'm currently teaching at Northumbria University, which is in Newcastle upon Tyne in the northeast of England. And I don't do the 1960s as much now, in part because of Dirty Harry, in fact. I've become more and more fascinated with the history of the San Francisco Bay Area in itself. So I do a module about the San Francisco Bay Area in popular culture. And I do another one on the Black Panther Party, which is my current research project. And the Black Panther Party was a Marxist-Leninist group in the 1960s, one of the most famous radical organizations of the time. So I've kind of moved on a little bit from Dirty Harry, but I'm hoping to loop back in the next project, which examines, as I say, the Bay Area in the 1960s and 70s.
And as I say, I was born in 1956, so I remember vividly when Dirty Harry came out and the controversy. I actually was too young to see it when it actually first came out, but I do know that it was an unbelievable time as far as you point out quite often in the book, is that it came out. What was the exact release date of Dirty Harry?
It was late 1971. It was one of the, right. the Christmas blockbuster movies, you might say now, although they didn't really exist at the time, but it was a big holiday movie.
And just to make sure everybody understands context, obviously I know some of this, but I want to talk to you about it. What was going on during this period that, because obviously the fact that it was a conservative backlash was for a good reason as far as the filmmakers. So what time period, this time period of 1971 or the 70s, early 70s, what kind of things were going on that there might be a need for, or a desire for some sort of a pushback from conservatives?
We have the decline of the civil rights movement. We have a rising sense that there's almost an urban crisis in the United States that's focused around inner city illegality, criminality, and violence, that itself is an articulation of the failures of big government, you might say, or that this is at least what the conservatives say. You have in 1966 the election of Ronald Reagan, 1968, then Richard Nixon, both following a very conservative path in terms of their rhetoric and in terms of their analysis of the problems facing the United States. And their combined election, you would have thought, would have solved the crisis if the Republicans or the conservative diagnosis was correct. But in actual fact, it gets worse. Vietnam becomes more and more problematic. There's more and more violence at home centered around the response to the anti-war movement. And it's kind of in this circumstances that Dirty Harry is released. And it touches on so many of these issues that I think it's hard to see it as anything other than a response to what is perceived to be a major crisis facing the United States.
Right, because I'm not as familiar with Reagan's governor campaign, but I do know that Nixon clearly ran on the idea of the quote-unquote silent majority and the people who weren't being listened to and who wanted things to get better. And, you know, he was looking for someone to bring us together was his big phrase at the time, even though clearly his politics and other aspects of him wouldn't necessarily think that there was a rallying cry going on, but he's clearly that was what he used to help get himself elected. Although, So obviously that comes into the whole idea of how he was able to get elected, and then from there, maybe as you point out, do a reversal against what was going on at the time that we meant many people on, especially on the conservative side, saw as negative.
Mm-hmm. No, very much so. And there are startling similarities in the two campaigns. You know, Reagan says that the statement or the position that he took that excited the most of his audiences, or the biggest number of people in his audiences, was his promise to clean up the mess at Berkeley. which was, of course, a reference to the University of California and the free speech movement, and this belief that these upstart students had taken advantage of the lassitude afforded them by left-wing professors and were, you know, intent on breaking down the fabric of society. And when he gets into power, one of the first things he does is he manages to politicize the Board of Regents, removes Clark Kerr, who's the head of the University of California, and attempt to take on the students. And you see the same sort of, you might say, anti-intellectualism in large swathes of conservative activism at this point. You know, similarly, Reagan's going on about budget. He has this advert that talks about, I think it talks about it is for people to be walking at night in cities, you know, and it's there are loads and loads of these little racial undertones that you also see in the Nixon campaign that is a lot more explicit. And yes, you're right, they're both appealing to this silent majority of people who, you know, pay their taxes but don't moan about things. And they moan about it through voting for Reagan and then Nixon.
And as you point out, California and that, you know, all but as you pointed, you know, since it's good that you're studying that area, because as the Bay Area, because it was an interesting time for a state that nowadays, if the average person would think of California as, you know, a liberal state, which of course isn't completely true. It's a big state and there's plenty of areas that are different from others. But San Francisco was definitely a focal point, not only the rest of the California and Berkeley and stuff, but San Francisco was also a focal point during that period. So you can see how all of these things sort of came together in Dirty Harry.
Oh, yeah, very much so. You know, the San Francisco, 1967, it's the human being. It attracts thousands of young runaways and wayways who come to partake in the counterculture, to experience all of this, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And it causes immense stress on the city's infrastructure. The police are constantly worried about, you know, what they're going to do with these people. And there's a large number of police who seem to quite be keen to club them over the head and send them back to their parents. You know, so there's what is going on in San Francisco, you might see, is it's almost like the nation in microcosm. And it's, of course, that's why the city of San Francisco looms so large over Dirty Harry the movie.
Right. So probably the two most important names when it comes to Dirty Harry, and one's more obvious than the other, but they're both there, is Don Siegel and Clint Eastwood. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit first about Siegel, because, you know, this was obviously not his first film. He had been making films, but what type of filmmaker was he at the point where how would you describe him as a filmmaker?
I think that the most frequent word that's used to describe Don Siegel is almost pejorative. He's an efficient filmmaker. He'd come through the studio system. He knew how to make films leanly and cheaply. And he knew how to, you know, you might say, get the most bang for your buck. He's chiefly famous for one of the most brilliant films, the 1950s Invasion of the Body Snatchers, a science fiction film about alien pod people coming down and taking over the United States. And his films were very much filled with this ambiguity that you didn't really know exactly who the heroes were and what the message of this movie was. But for the studios, you know, he's a director who they know can be given a script, can shoot it very quickly, get it out on the screen, and for it to make money, which is, you know, kind of why he makes so many, you know, supposed B movies. and by the time of 1970, he was in the midst of quite a collaboration with Clint Eastwood. They'd made a number of movies together. They enjoyed working together. And for Siegel, he found in Eastwood somebody who actually excited him, I think, as a star. They would have discussions on you know, setups and shots and what worked best. And Siegel said that, you know, even if he didn't use what Eastwood suggested, he would then think of another idea that kind of piggybacked on it. So he was clearly very interested in working with Eastwood himself. But, you know, you might say that he's kind of the junior partner in this by the time of Dirty Harry.
Right. And obviously anyone who knows anything about Eastwood as a director have heard stories. Clearly Eastwood learned a lot from him, because one of the things that you usually hear about Clint Eastwood as a director is that he's very lean. He has gotten, you know, taken on the speed or efficiency angle as far as his filmmaking.
Oh, very much so. You know, he'd worked with Sergio Leone, who was notoriously quite long-winded, in the sense that he would take, you know, have enormous amount of takes, and the movies would take a long time to be produced. He was also in a movie, I can't remember who wrote it. It's in the book, so you'd have to buy it to find this out, where there was an interminable filmmaking process, and Eastwood found this incredibly frustrating. And working with Siegel, I think he found it really a breath of fresh air. You know, one or two takes, get it done, move on to the next one, and he absorbed that himself. And that's one of the things that characterizes a Clint Eastwood movie is that leanness and spareness. You know, he sees it in his directing in very functional terms. Is get what's there onto film as soon as you can, and normally as cheaply as you can.
I guess it's a good thing that Eastwood never worked with Stanley Kubrick. I think there would have been somebody would not have come out alive of that.
Well, yeah, you know, and we see it with Phil Kaufman. He works with Phil Kaufman on The Outlaw Josie Wales, and cannot work with him. And such is his star power, he manages to get Kaufman ejected from the movie and completes it himself.
Yeah, I remember the big deal with Invasion of Body Snatchers, which of course got remade later, but in the 50s when it came out, people looked at it as a Cold War allegory about, you know, the Russians, either the Russians are going to be able to come over and take over and we wouldn't know about it. And then, of course, Siegel he basically said that there was nothing. He wasn't trying to make a point. He wasn't trying to be political. This is the movie is what the movie was.
Yeah, he did. And, you know, and I think what's so skillful about that movie is that it enables you to read it both ways. You can read it as an allegory about, you know, the impersonal nature of communism. You could also read it as the groupthink of McCarthyism. And that's what I think is really interesting. And he said more or less the same thing about Dirty Harry when it came out. He said it's not a conservative film. And he didn't see any politics in it. He was a lifelong Democrat, and he believed in, you know, racial equality and all of those classic liberal things. And, you know, that in a sense makes him kind of an interesting filmmaker, because it demonstrates that somebody with liberal intentions can, in fact, make a conservative film. And that sometimes, you know, when we examine films, we have to be very wary and careful of what the screenwriters, what the directors, what the cinematographer, and all of those people, what they intended, because what they intend is not necessarily what they make.
And the other thing about Siegel's films, and, you know, given the time period, it's important to point out, is they tended to be violent.
Oh, yeah. You know, a B-movie tends to have, you know, car chases, violence, you know, not necessarily the sort of ultra violence that you see today. I mean, you know, by today's standards, they look quite tame, but they are, you know, particularly his early films are very, very exciting. There's quite a bit of kinetic filmmaking. There's always something happening. There's always a dead body. There's always somebody getting beaten up here, there, and everywhere. And of course, you know, by today's standards, Dirty Harry is quite tame, but at the time in 1971, there's a lot of violence going on, and it feeds off the violence that you see in other movies of the late 1960s. You know, Bonnie and Clyde is the classic one where you know, a bank teller gets shot in the face, and then Bonnie and Clyde die horribly at the end. Everybody talks about the Wild Bunch, you know, which is has these balletic scenes of slow motion violence with people getting torn limb from limb by machine guns and stuff like that. And Dirty Harry has its fair share of violence in there. You know, it's a component feature of Siegel's work. And in fact, you might say the general films for adults of the late 1960s, early 1970s.
Okay, now turning to Clint Eastwood, we've obviously talked about him. At this point in his career, I mean, obviously he had been making films for how long by the time Dirty Harry came out? Quite a while.
Well, he'd been making films for about 8 or 9 years. You know, his first major breakthrough, he'd been making a major star for about that period. He'd been making films since the 1950s. He's in one of the sequels to the Creature from the Black Lagoon. He's also chiefly known for Rawhide, the very long-running TV show, which is a Western. And it's that that enables him to be cast by Sergio Leone in the Dollars trilogy, where he plays the man with no name, which is the film role that really shoots him to superstardom. And that's the thing that he's most known for in 1971, this taciturn loner who arrives in certain communities, shoots the bad guys, and then moves on somewhere else. You know, and that's kind of an oversimplification, because what he also brought to this role is this sense of kind of, it's almost like it's amoral attitude. His films, he doesn't really mind who are the good guys, and he leads the viewers to think, well, you know, who is on the right side here? Who is on the bad side? What do we do as the audience? And The Man with No Name offers no real answers all the way through. So he's, you know, so Eastwood, at the point where he makes this film, is he's chiefly known as this man with no name, and his three films prior to Dirty Harry with Don Siegel play off this. He plays he's a cowboy in The Mules for Sister Sarah. He plays a Northern Civil War soldier in The Beguiled, and he plays Walt Coogan in Coogan's Bluff, who is essentially a cowboy translated or transplanted to New York City. So that's who he is in 1970. He is also probably the biggest movie star of the time. So, you know, he's a big deal in American cinema. Plus, he just made his first movie, Play Misty for Me, which itself was heavily influenced by Don Siegel. And Don Siegel himself actually appeared in it as a wise bartender, a heavily symbolic role in itself.
There's no question that he made films that, as you say, could have almost be, you know, his early career, especially, and then television, you know, Westerns and this character, but sometimes almost B-movie level. But on the other hand, he also made films that nowadays people look back as being very classic as far as what they presented and what they were. I mean, even, you know, now the Man with No Name trilogy is considered to be a classic, you know, series, a classic series of movies.
Yeah, they very much are, and you know they're incredibly skillfully made movies, and they're still very, very watchable, and in part that's because of Leone's use of sound and his use of landscape, but it's also because of Eastwood himself. He's an incredibly magnetic screen presence, helped by the fact that he doesn't say much, you know, and that enables you to read into him, you know, almost what you want to, and that I think makes them you know, superlative films. And I think what Eastwood and Siegel himself, what they do is they call into question this this division between A movies and B movies, and they do help to elevate the B movie to art form, you know, if that's not too pretentious a statement to make.
I sometimes think people who are used to movies today and any kind of media today, how they, and the biggest complaint I hear sometimes is, it's so quiet, the movie is so quiet. And I said, well, you know, that, and that's the thing back in, you know, you talk about, you know, the Dirty Harry, or in any of his films, Clint Eastwood is not a huge talker. I can't think of any of them where you would say to him that you would say that you get his presence from visuals and the way he does things and then the occasional words. But he's always been someone, both in his acting and in, you know, his own directing, that values silence as much as he values sound.
Oh, yeah, very much so. And I think that comes from Leone. You know, one of Leone's great uses is silence, you know, particularly in the third volume of the trilogy, Once Upon a Time in the West. You really get a sense of, you know, of just the terror of silence. And I agree with you that nowadays movies are full of so many auditory cues that you're being manipulated to think a certain thing, whereas, you know, back in the 1960s, 1970s, you get a lot more science, you get a lot more of a naturalistic sound to those, and Eastwood is part of that. You know, like I say, he doesn't talk much, and for me, his less successful movies are the ones where he's very talkative. I think in Hang 'Em High, which is kind of the B-movie Western that comes in the wake of the Dollars trilogy, he does a lot of talking, and the film itself is far less powerful than him when he's standing around stalking people or just looking at them. And that's what makes him such a monumental presence in American cinema, I think, is just that face. It's like Mount Rushmore, or something as powerful as that. You know, anytime you see it on the big screen, it makes an impression.
So let's talk a little bit about Eastwood and his politics. We've already talked about Siegel saying, making the point that he didn't mean this to be, he didn't see this as a political statement. As you point out, he's a Democrat and so on. Eastwood, on the other hand, we can't necessarily say that's the case in his case. He certainly was much more political, not even just with films, but in his life. Where would you put him on this at this point in particular on the scale for people who may not be completely aware of Clint Eastwood's politics?
Well, at this point in his life, he campaigns for Richard Nixon. He's kind of a mainstream Republican. He has libertarian leanings that really come out as he matures as a person over the next 30, 40 years. But at this time, he seems to me to be kind of a mainstream Republican voice. He's in favor of small government, leaving the little guy to do his own thing, get the government off our backs, that sort of stuff. But he's not as I don't think he's as ideologically driven as some people see him today, in the wake of some of the things he's done in recent years. But he's very much a small C conservative. And, the interesting thing to me about the Siegel-Eastwood relationship is Siegel protested that they never, ever talked about politics. We don't know whether that's true or not, but they certainly found a way to work together, despite them having slightly different views about the way that the world should be.
And one of the other things is, even though as time goes on and Eastwood becomes more and more the face of conservative Hollywood, he still makes movies that you can't always say, you clearly can't consistently say have a political bent to them.
No, that's very true. Some of these films are articulate incredibly liberal sentiments, and that again, it speaks to me again of Siegel himself. That, Siegel's a liberal who occasionally made conservative films. Eastwood is a conservative who occasionally makes very liberal films, really films that are far more, I think, humane than some of his own personal politics are. And I think that just adds to his mystique, really. It makes him a very much more interesting filmmaker than if he was a straight down the line conservative making conservative films, or indeed if he was a liberal making liberal films.
Yeah, I can think of the best example I can think of something like that would be the two films he made as World War II films, Flags of Our Fathers, and unfortunately I can't remember the second film, which was taken from the Japanese side.
Yeah, Sands of Iwo Jima.
That's it, Sands of Iwo Jima. So
yeah,
that in itself is clearly somebody who's trying to better understand or show understanding or present ways of looking at things that you can't put them in a bubble and say, oh, well, this person's just this way.
Yeah, yeah. And I think part of that, I think he expresses a frustration with this, that in some of the quotes I use in epigrams for the book, he said, why do people see politics in this? Why do they think it's, the people who read politics into what I make are kind of daft and goofy, and, why aren't they just appreciating it as film? And I think he does see a genuine disconnect between what he makes and what he believes. And again, that simply adds to how interesting an individual and how interesting a filmmaker he is, in that he is able, I think, mainly to separate those two almost diametrically opposed impulses, you might say, in his mind.
So now turning to Dirty Harry, and obviously it's not one film. There were a total of five Dirty Harry films. I think that's right.
Five, yeah.
And obviously the first one, I'm assuming there was no major plan to do this as a group. It was just a matter that they were making a film, and that was that. Is there a particular thing with him that San Francisco ended up, they decided that San Francisco would be a good setting? Is Eastwood have any particular ties to San Francisco?
He's from nearby. He served in the army at Fort Ord, which is nearby San Francisco, during the Korean War. Originally, Dirty Harry was due to be based in New York City, but when Siegel got the job, and when it turned out that Eastwood would be the star, they simply picked San Francisco, they said, because they were nearby and they liked the atmosphere there. So in some respects, it's kind of serendipitous. But I don't think that detracts from San Francisco's role in the film itself. You know, I think San Francisco plays a key role in the movie and becomes a character in and of itself. You know, they didn't design this as a series. It was simply a standalone movie. I've no reason to believe that they thought it was anything other than many of the other films that they've been shooting. They got a script, they shot it quickly, got it edited, and then released, and then they would move on to whichever project they moved on to next.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I recently interviewed an author about geography in Hollywood and the concept of settings, mm-hmm. and sometimes the settings are totally imaginary in that you get a city that's not really the city that's supposed to stand in. But then in this case, as you point out, San Francisco, you could put up on the screen starring Clint Eastwood and San Francisco.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very much so. And I think it's encoded in that first scene, which I think is brilliantly executed, where the criminal of the film has shot a woman who is bathing in a rooftop swimming pool of the Holiday Inn. And Eastwood, or Dirty Harry, investigates the crime. He sees her body, notices the only vantage point from where she could have been shot, which is the Bank of America tower in San Francisco. And he heads up to the top of the tower. And instead of going straight to the point where he can look over the top of this roof and down to the other one, he prowls around the edge of the roof, and it enables this beautiful panning shot where you see the entirety of San Francisco laid out before you, almost like in the grid pattern. And it very much demonstrates that this film is set in the real San Francisco, and they use a number of real places in San Francisco. They use the real mayor's office, and they use the city hall when they go out into the final shootout. It's out in Marin County. So all the time they're using real San Francisco locations. But what I think is very, very skillful about it is it doesn't use the cliched ones. You know, there's only one shot that really explicitly references the Golden Gate Bridge. They head off to sort of other, you know, especially now, some of which have been demolished. But they demonstrate that this is a real city. This is not the city of your imagination. This I'd have seen in I don't know, What's Up Doc or other films set in this, you know, this beautiful, hilly Bayview area. This is a gritty, down-to-earth San Francisco, one that has the sort of urban problems that people are seeing in their own cities around the nation.
I assume, I don't remember now because it's been a while since I've seen the film, but I don't remember if we see Lombard Street in Dirty Harry.
No, we don't. I think we see it in, we might see it in one of the others, in one of the later ones, but no, you don't see that. You know, it takes for the, it takes until the third, or the second sequel rather, for them to view the Coit Tower. You know, so it's a San Francisco that is both known and unknown, right. I think, but still a San Francisco that's very vivid and important to the movie.
And I think the word we probably would use to describe it these days would be gritty, is probably, you know, we're trying to see a city more for its underbelly than, because obviously it's a crime film in that sense. And so we're not trying to show it in its necessarily best light, but certainly not, you know, it's more realistic light is probably what they were looking for.
Yeah. So you have scenes that are shot in Potrero Hill, where there's an African-American community. You have the very famous scene where he becomes a peeping Tom and sees and spies a local neighborhood woman by the name of Hot Mary, who's topless, and he gets beaten up in a back street. The iconic scene with the bank robber, where he says, did I shoot 5 shots or 6? He's just been at a fairly lousy diner eating a hot dog, sees this thing happening, and all hat loose in the town. So yeah, this is a gritty city. This is a city that is dangerous. This is the city where you have these kind of what Reagan referred to as jungle paths at night, where unknown assailants are forever prowling, and where there's a serial killer wandering around, killing people almost at random.
So setting the stage, then obviously we've talked around it. Obviously, the film on its basic level is the story of a search for a serial killer, and Harry Callahan, or Dirty Harry, is a policeman for the San Francisco Police mm-hmm. Department. So he gets involved in this investigation to try to find this serial killer. Well, of course, it ends up becoming much more very quickly, and this is where some of the more controversial aspects of this film begin to come in. But the bottom line is, its initial point is to be a police story about trying to find a serial killer at its simplest level.
Yeah, it's the very basic, cop sees disorder, or the police see disorder in the city. They investigate. They intend to create order again. And they find it by solving the crime, killing the perpetrator and restoring the city to its former glory. That's itself at a very, very simplistic level. But as you suggest, there's an awful lot underneath it that I think means it's a lot richer as a film than many people first think. For example, we see the police mired in bureaucracy. One of them berates Harry Callahan for not filling out a form and not preparing a written report. Meanwhile, the police are fascinated with new technology. They want to get computer analysis to predict where the Scorpio killer, the serial killer, will attack next time. They want to buy a helicopter to have this panoptic view of the city to spy him and sweat him out. Meanwhile, Callahan is saying we go for traditional methods. We walk the streets. We use our informant network. And we use, the implication being we use my brilliance as a detective to work out exactly where he will strike next, and we will take whatever action appropriate or is even inappropriate to stop him killing again.
And of course, that's right at the beginning of the film that we're pretty quickly introduced to Harry Callahan, the character, as far as his willingness to not necessarily follow the rules and, the rogue cop concept, which of course has become the norm anymore in any kind of cop story, whether it's in television or the movies. There's always got to be at least one policeman who's rogue, but he was probably one of the first real rogue cops. They keep pointing out the shooting scene, which is early on in the film, and we're immediately introduced to somebody who's not necessarily going to follow all the rules.
That's very much so. There are a couple of more muted rogue cop movies beforehand. Bullitt and The Detective are some of the chief ones, but this is the first time we see a film where you really cannot tell the difference between the policeman and a regular criminal. He shoots people willy-nilly, he assaults people, he beats people up, he doesn't abide by any of the legal niceties that regular police have to abide by in the 1960s. And of course, what the film says is that this gets results. Dirty Harry is proved to be right on pretty much every dilemma he faces or any problem he faces, and he comes up tops. Meanwhile, the technocrats and the bureaucrats are left floundering because the criminals are able to take advantage of all of these bureaucratic advantages that they're given by the police to continue their crime sprees. And Callahan comes in and stops it with brute force.
And of course, what's interesting about it's, even though this is supposedly, you know, a crime drama trying to find the killer, we find the killer. He finds the killer reasonably early on in the film. It's not a matter that they wait till the very end. You know, he actually captures him early, you know, partway through the film. But he does things that will lead to the issues related to, you know, proper procedure. And of course, all those little buzzwords by this point in the 1960s and early 70s would tend to make the, you know, some conservatives in particular to be a little unhappy. Things like rights and you know, prisoner rights and those kinds of things.
Oh, very much so. They have a cat and mouse scene where Callahan is sent around. He runs for about 16 miles, I calculated, and has an encounter with the Scorpio killer, stabs him in the leg, but is pistol whipped himself and falls unconscious. They then re-encounter each other at the Kizar Stadium, where Callahan shoots him. And Callahan is then upbraided by the deputy district attorney, who says, you know, have you never heard of the Escobedo decision? Have you never heard of the Miranda rights? And of course, Harry Callahan doesn't care about reading somebody their rights and reminding them of the right to remain silent. He just wants to get this guy and find out where he has, well, where this criminal has hidden a kidnapped woman. And of course, by torturing the man, he gets the information. But of course, they cannot actually use it in any criminal case that transpires, because the information is gathered illegally. And again, this reinforces Callahan's frustration with, you know, liberals, with bureaucracy, and with, you know, 1960s policing. You know, and at one point he said, "Well, the law is an ass," and slams the door and walks out. And I think that encapsulates that conservative critique of 1960s liberalism.
So when the film comes out, obviously, based on everything we've talked about, they did not, you know, they weren't making a film for any kind of reaction on a political level. I keep saying they, because I do think in this particular case, you can easily say that Siegel and Eastwood were collaborators on this film, even though Siegel is the listed director. So when the film is released, how quickly, or were there even pre-release commentary or articles or discussion about what might be expected of this film?
Well, what I found was that simply that the film was initially presented and promoted as one of these star vehicles. You know, the promotional material are about Clint Eastwood being the biggest film star and the best paid film stars of the time. You see his image on the billboard posters with this, you know, this lovely tagline, you know, this is a film about a homicidal maniac and a detective, and, you know, and Harry Callahan and a homicidal maniac. Harry is the one with the badge, you know, designed to make you think about this duality. So I don't think it is presented as a major contribution to what you might call the political milieu of the 1970s. It's presented as holiday entertainment. It's such, you know, after Christmas, in between Christmas and New Year, maybe you get your rocks off by seeing Clint Eastwood doing what he does, which is guys and restore order to the city.
But obviously, where did we first start to see? I don't know whether you want to use the word reactions that to what we now see as the political aspects of the film. How quickly does that start?
I'm not really sure, to be honest, because the way I took the film was more to examine it in terms of how it reflected what was going on in the 1970s, rather than it as a major contribution to politics. You know, the film especially was essentially dismissed by the serious film critics as a piece of garbage, a piece of trash, you know. But I didn't see anybody like Richard Nixon saying, "Oh, this is what we've got to do." But I certainly get the sense that it contributed to this feeling amongst you know, mainstream American audiences, that, you know, the urban crisis had gone too far, and that this sort of authority figure was maybe necessary to restore this order.
Of course, then, and obviously there's so much to talk about just with the first film, but we want to obviously at the end of the first film, it looked like it was going to be a standalone. He throws his badge and seemingly quits at the end of the first film. And we think that's the end of Dirty Harry. But of course we get sequels. Was it just a matter? I mean, I guess I should have asked this. How popular was the film? I mean, did it obviously well enough to do sequels, but did it show popularity, or was it pretty much watched and then moved on? Obviously, being released at Christmas time, they obviously had their hope for popularity.
Yeah, it makes a serious amount of money. I can't remember the figures precisely, but it makes a big profit for the studio. I think we're talking in the region of $40 million. So.
Which is quite a large amount at that time of the, in the 1970s. That's a huge.
Yeah. And that enables, I think what is significant in terms of Eastwood's career is that this enables him to continue to work on the project that he really enjoys working with. And when the studio comes back to him and says, look, you've got to make another Dirty Harry movie, he can put up with doing that because this gives him more latitude to make these interesting films like Honky Tonk Man and all of those other ones that are closer to his heart. So it's a very profitable film, but it's also a film that gives him freedom as an artist to do what he wants to do. And that, I think, is part of the reason why he returns to Harry Callahan so many times.
Yeah, we hear about this with other artists who do the same kind of thing. They don't mind making the so-called popular film where the one that's going to likely make a lot of money as long as it gives them the ability. And Eastwood's a perfect example of that, where he's made so many interesting films that wouldn't necessarily be considered to be box office magnets. But there are cover areas that interest him, obviously Bird and some of his other, he's always had an interest in jazz, and jazz appears throughout all of his films, but it gives him the opportunity. He makes these other films. And some of them, obviously, as we're pointing out here, they're not all B-movies, but they're clearly made for more popular reasons, and then it allows him to do some of the other things he wants to do.
No, yeah, very much. And this is, it's the classic idea. We do one for the studio, one for me. So there's kind of a quid pro quo in there for him. And, I think he quite happily makes them, and he sees them really as a way to connect with friends almost. He chooses easygoing directors. He works with people that he's worked with for a long time, so they're not a great strain on him as an individual and as the star and as the focus of the film. He has an enjoyable time on set. He gets them done. He says to John Milius allegedly, they don't have to be good, they just have to be cheap. Get them out and move on to the next one. And that kind of, it fits perfectly with his working methods. He says, I get a pencil, I come up with an idea, I then make it as a film, and then I move on. These films are exactly the same.
Although there's parts of me that still don't completely understand why anybody thought he would be a good person to bring on for Jersey Boys. But, that's a separate issue right there. I mean, musicals, no. I mean, even a musical that's supposed to take place when it takes place in a group of people, it's still not what I would have considered to be an obvious vehicle for Clint Eastwood as a director.
No, I wish I could have provided an answer to that, but it completely stumped me as well.
So the sequels, obviously, any sequel, as we usually know when it comes to sequels, that in very few situations can we say that the sequels in any way, shape, or form even come close to the originals. Mm. But was there anything more? I mean, obviously there's four sequels, so to try to discuss them in any detail is going to be pretty hard to do. But were there any attempts, do you see, that the sequels were meant to be as good or aimed towards the first film, or were they more made for either for other reasons?
I think primarily they're made to make money. These are genuine box office films that the studio knows that you put Clint Eastwood on the top and you've got Dirty Harry in the title, that you're going to get a decent return, and a number of them make enough, and they keep on making enough money to keep the studio happy. So that's the first thing. But I also think what they do is once they decide to make a sequel, they have to work out how to make that sequel speak to the original and any preceding sequels. So in essence, they exist in dialogue with the original. And you know, this is why in the second movie, Harry Callahan is pitted against some real Nazis, because critics of Dirty Harry said that he was a fascist. You know, he rebelled in strength and he was quite prepared to crush anybody who opposed him. So in the second one, he's against a group of rogue policemen who are going around killing people dressed in black leather. So just in case you hadn't missed it, they look a bit like Nazi stormtroopers. And Clinton is, Callahan is there as the voice of reason. He said, I would never do this sort of thing. You know, I'm there to protect the system. You know, then the third one sees them fighting radical left wingers, you know, a thinly disguised Symbionese Liberation Army, you know, and again, so it's now he's back on the right, you know, and he's showing that extremism is the problem. It's moderate conservatism that you should be in favor of. Then they realize that, you know, maybe a Dirty Harriet would be a good thing. So he's pitted against a woman who he falls in love with, who is taking some people who gang raped her. And then in the end, he takes on the media and this rogue filmmaker who's decided to kill a load of people, including Harry himself. So there's a degree of self-reflexivity. So at each time, these sequels turn around what you're expecting from the previous sequel, attempt to add a little bit of nuance to his story, but I think inevitably end up just simply reinforcing it. And that they end up, you know, with Callahan, played by a 58-year-old Eastwood, who is just far too old to be convincing as a policeman. And it's kind of a blessed relief, I think, that the Deadpool was the last one, that they didn't carry on and make any more as he gets increasingly infirm.
And yet he still does make, in a movie like Sudden Impact came out, which wasn't a Dirty Harry movie, but certainly has some aspects, some echoes of Dirty Harry in it.
Are you thinking of Tightrope?
I'm sorry?
Are you thinking of Tightrope there? Yeah. No, that's no problem. When I was thinking about this podcast, I was trying to make sure I got it in my head, because I've made that mistake so many times. They are very similar films. You know, Tightrope is essentially Dirty Harry, or divorced Dirty Harry, transplanted to New Orleans, and he immerses himself in this sort of voodoo atmosphere of New Orleans, and gets involved with some kind of they call it extreme sort of sexual practices and so on. But essentially, you can see this film as Dirty Harry, and you can see Callahan echoing in various of his roles, you know, right up until Walt Kowalski in Gran Torino, which you might see as a retired Harry Callahan back in Detroit now, inveighing against immigrants and the decline of the American dream.
Right, and you're right. I was thinking, you know, names of Clint Eastwood films, because I remember Tightrope. It was the funny part about it is Eastwood never presents himself as being, or at least in the obvious films, as being too. What word do I? He shows flaws. I think there's no question that the scene in as you point you've already mentioned in the first Dirty Harry film where he's a peeping Tom, and you know, there's clearly he's not trying to pretend that he's this perfect person.
Mm. Well, yeah, he's a voyeur. You know, he's a peeping Tom. At another point, he has a set of binoculars, and he's staring at this woman who appears to be inviting two men into a house for a threesome. In the second film, he is one of the people who live in his apartment block. An Asian American woman says, "You know, what does it take to go to bed with you?" And he said, "All you need to do is knock on the door." You know, so he's somebody who is. I suppose it's not so much flaws I see as it's somebody who's human. And has these foibles, but you know they are very much encoded in certain expectations of masculinity. You know, he's obviously heterosexual. He takes aim at one of the revolutionaries in the third movie. He calls him a effing fruit before blowing him up with a bazooka. you know, and he's very much in favor of family values. When one of his colleagues' wives expresses her sexual frustration and suggests that the two of them get together, he declines and you know, moves swiftly on. So again, you know, highly conservative but very masculine at the same time. And I think that's part of the things that I find interesting about those sequels, is the way that they reinforce his masculinity, you know, as a real American man.
So then obviously the end of the book, the last chapter, Dirty Harry Callahan and American Popular Culture. Obviously there's a lot of things that can be said, because it turned out to be such a groundbreaking film in so many ways. And we've already talked a lot about some of the things that have come out of it, the Rogue Cop and things like that. And now it's just become a regular theme in, like I say, not even just movies, but television shows as well. But do you see the Dirty Harry films and Dirty Harry as a character having a lasting impact on films and making political statements with them?
I think so, because, you know, anytime you have a rogue cop, anytime you have somebody who stands up for these traditional rights, they are either explicitly or implicitly referencing Dirty Harry. You know, I think that in terms of his, you know, Callahan's position in the culture, you only need to point to the fact that he appears in The Simpsons, you know, and as soon as anything appears in The Simpsons, that's kind of prima facie evidence that they are an American icon, you might say. And there's no introduction to it. It's simply a character who looks a bit like Clint Eastwood, talks a bit like Clint Eastwood, behaves a bit like Clint Eastwood as Dirty Harry, albeit with comedic outcomes. And I think those are the two signs that forever will be kind of in his shadow in many respects. And what we see with rogue cops nowadays is that they always end up referencing some part of Dirty Harry. It might be the lack of a home life that's referenced in Dirty Harry in the original film. It might be that he, you know, he doesn't play by the rules. It might be that he has a tense relationship with his superior. He doesn't like bureaucracy. All of those things we trace back to Dirty Harry himself. So it will forever be a touchstone for American filmmakers, whether they like it or not. You know, and the fact that the Library of Congress have chosen to preserve it as a key film in American history is another piece of evidence that it's going to be there, whether we like it or not, for the foreseeable future.
Well, he's not unwilling to reference himself. Obviously, we see some aspects of the Dirty Harry character in many of his own performances. I can think of in The Line of Fire, where he clearly is, he's a loner, he's alone, he doesn't have anybody, he only has his job, he's haunted by the past, and clearly, even though, you know, you see that he didn't obviously direct that film, but he certainly appeared as that same aspects of his character.
Yeah, you know, Clint Eastwood's screen persona is indelibly marked with Dirty Harry. That, you know, as soon as you see him on screen, you know exactly what you're going to get. As we've talked earlier on, he's going to be he's not going to say very much. He's going to be quite critical of the rules. He's going to get the job done, and he may well shoot somebody at some point. You know, and I think the kind of the end of the story arc comes in Gran Torino in Walt Kowalski, who sort of ends up repudiating everything that Dirty Harry stands for by engaging with the immigrants in Detroit, and learning how he'd shut himself off from the world, and eventually he comes to this crisis point, which ends with his apotheosis, just at the same point that he renounces the violence that Dirty Harry is renowned for. And I think it's, you know, Gran Torino is a very, very interesting film, simply from that perspective of Clint Eastwood finally acknowledging Dirty Harry's indelible influence and indelible impact on his own career, and his attempts, I see, to put Dirty Harry to bed, even though I think Dirty Harry will wake up time and time again.
So I have to ask, as we're getting towards the end, what were the reactions when you showed Dirty Harry in your classes? What kind of reaction from people who I assume were all, none of them were American, I would assume they were all British or mm-hmm. you know, lived in Britain. What kind of reactions did you mm-hmm. see from your students for a film that in many ways many people would identify as being particularly an American film?
I think the first thing that always they were saying is that how cool was Clint Eastwood. They loved the character, which I found quite disconcerting because by this time I'd seen the film, you know, dozens of times already and was kind of quite sick of him. They really hit home that really hit home with them, the way he, you know, the way he deals with criminals, that his one-liners, his quips. And I think that was a reflection of the way that the film presents Dirty Harry's ideology as common sense. You know, we know that common sense is highly ideological and constructed in itself, but it seems very simple and straightforward. So that was the thing they homed in on. But I think they genuinely enjoyed the film. They found it, you know, they still find, or they found the distance from, you know, this is 40 years after the event, so that film styles were very different then. They found some of the sequences a little boring. They didn't find the violence troubling at all because it was, you know, by their standards, very, very tame. But because of the way that the module was constructed, I'd already given them a lecture on the sort of things to look out for. So I'd asked them to look out for the religious symbolism, you know, the way that the cross appears from time to time and the way that he utters Jesus Christ at one or two occasions. You know, what does the Scorpio character represent? And they would always notice that he was a countercultural figure who had long hair, who called the police pigs and those sort of things. So they actually were able to read into it really, really well, I thought. But I think overridingly, they actually enjoyed the film as a film, which I thought was actually quite heartening in kind of a way, because, you know, by that stage I was, you know, to be frank, sick of the film.
Well, as I say, this is an interesting period of time in filmmaking, obviously, and it mm-hmm. has now become a pretty regular area where we see a lot of study now in this period of filmmaking for a variety, not just for, in this mm-hmm. case, for, you know, like cop films, but other types of films as well. And so, and then I think your points about, and your book really does a great job of first giving the background of the whole film, you know, where both background of Clint Eastwood and Siegel, and then how the film was made and the part of the city and the importance of the city and then so on. So I have to say,
thank you.
I hope that people will reach out for this book because, I mean, it's been out now for it was released in 2016, I think.
2016.
But it's still from, you know, I always like books that try to do what yours does, which is to give us overview, a real sense of the entire film, not just the film itself, but the background and the time period and all those things. So I have to tell you, I really enjoyed talking to you about this film, and I think we've only really scratched the surface. And even though you're probably pretty much tired of Dirty Harry, I still think that I hope that you know, your interest, that you've presented enough information here that people will see the book for what it is, which is a great study of an important character and film and filmmakers.
Oh, thank you so much. That's very kind of you to say, Joel. You know, it's really heartening to see that hear a reader say that they enjoyed it. And that's the reason I wrote the book, was to get people to enjoy reading about it. And, you know, I didn't want it to be one of these dry academic exercises that is alienating to either a general reader or indeed a student. And I'm really, really heartened to hear that. You know, I may have been successful in at least part of that that ambition. So thank you very much for saying so.
Well, I do try to talk. I mean, I'm a firm fan of many books that do the same kind of thing, in the sense that they try that they present all much information. There's been some really great books out on various films and that do the same kind of thing. And I just think that yours is right up there. So as I say, I hope people reach out for it. And as I say, it's published by University Press of Florida. As I say, hopefully it will continue to be of interest and people will continue to read it. And I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak to me. And it's later in the day for you, but we were able to work out a time that worked for both of us. So thank you very much for your time.
Oh, thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure. I've really enjoyed every moment of this. And I hope people who listen to this get a similar amount of enjoyment out of the book.
Thanks a lot.
My great thanks to Joe. The first Dirty Harry film in particular is still considered a groundbreaking movie, and I hope that Joe's book will give you new insights into the entire series. This is Joel Cherney, and I will be back soon with more New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network.